The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of ExchangeWire's Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at ExchangeWire, and I am absolutely thrilled to be joined by Addy Cutts, Regional Director for APAC at Oracle Advertising. Hello, Addy.
Hello, Anne-Marie. Thank you very much for having me. Lovely to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you, and we really appreciate you tuning in from Sydney when your regular home base is Singapore.
Yep, it's been a long time coming. First work trip for 3 years. The last trip was also in Sydney, and it's 8 o'clock in the evening. So looking forward to this.
Okay, we'll crack on then. I'm also chuffed to be joined by our CEO, Rachel Smith, who equally is joining us from the other side of the planet. Rachel, how are you and where are you?
I'm very well, thanks, AMS. Back to AMS, I'm afraid, regular listeners. Can't be calling you Anne-Marie, Patricia Sheedy. And yes, I'm in far less glamorous than Sydney, Canberra, but on the same time zone as Addy. So yeah, I can see he's got his I'm ready for dinner face on. So it's tea time.
We'll just crack on, right? So we'll get straight into the first story, which is on TrustPID, which is post cookie identifiers, and it's about European telcos unite for opt in targeting offering from TechCrunch. So a coalition of European telco operators are advancing plans to launch a joint venture that will allow mobile users to opt in to personalized ad targeting. The venture, currently named TrustPID, as in P for Papa, I for Identifier, D for Delta, will be equally owned by and controlled by Germany's Deutsche Telekom, France's Orange, and Spain's Telefonica, and the UK's Vodafone. So, according to this article, the group asserts that the offering, which was tested in Germany last year, will run on a first-party data targeting framework that uses pseudonymized tokens to enable brands and publishers to recognize users without personally identifiable information. It's pretty crucial, right? But what I think is interesting, in a filing made to the competition unit of the European Commission, the telcos assert that TrustPID will provide a privacy-led digital identification solution to support the digital marketing and advertising activities of brands and publishers. What's also interesting is the Commission will have until the 10th of February, so that's not long, right, to approve or reject the proposal. The initiative has already drawn the attention of privacy regulators and commentators who question whether it is in line with GDPR. And what is also interesting, in their filing, the coalition states that TrustPID targeting will only occur where explicit user consent has been provided via opt-in. Right. So there's a lot of information there, which hopefully we'll kind of unpick. And I'm going to come to you first. And my question to you is, could TrustPID be a successful solution for what we call or define as the post-cookie era? What are your thoughts?
There was quite a lot to unpack in this article.
Totally.
And it was kind of hard to put my finger on, but my initial feeling when reading the announcement was that for some reason, fundamentally, it just felt like a bad idea for a whole host of reasons. I couldn't quite work out why to begin with, and I couldn't really understand what the main intent was for these telco operators to collect the first party data. And it almost felt like it was being purposefully vague, which obviously raises a few alarm bells. So then I had a look at the TrustPID website, and actually on kind of further examination, it looked like they're probably trying to make a positive impact. The wording on the website states that advertising on the internet is currently in the hands of a few dominant platform operators, agreed. This dominance could increase further with the imminent end of so-called third-party cookies. But publishers, that urgently depend on advertising to support the creation of content are therefore looking for ways to become more independent whilst at the same time maintaining protection standards, et cetera, through transparency and control. Now, I come from a publishing background, and so I'm super supportive, wholly supportive of any initiatives that can help premium publishers to thrive and continue to provide quality, independent content that's free of charge, keep the internet free, et cetera. So on further examination, it looks like it's a good initiative. I just feel like from a consumer's perspective, I would probably question, like, why would the telco operators be the ones who are collecting this data? It seems confusing from a consumer's perspective as to whether it would be a publisher, whether it would be a brand who owns the data, whether it be the telco operator, whether it would be the handset manufacturers themselves. There's just a lot of players in the market. And as a consumer, again, you'd probably be well within your rights to think, well, I'm paying good money for this net access to the network. Why am I providing additional data? What's it going to be used for? What's the true purpose? And I feel that in this space, I think we could probably all agree that trust is paramount. And that also occurred to me as well that, why did I feel so strongly about it? And it's probably because it's a mobile handset. Mobile handsets can be seen as sometimes referred to as an extension of ourselves because they're just highly personal items. And so I feel like we probably need to be hypersensitive to users. Why would the telcos be collecting data rather than anybody else?
You raise a few interesting points there, Adi, and I'm going to come to you, Rachel, because I'm sure you've got a few thoughts. But what I found interesting from your initial response is that you talk about consumers, but then you break it down in terms of brands and publishers and telcos and stuff. But as consumers, that's not how they think. That's not how they operate. And before we kind of dig into that, Rachel, I'm curious to understand your thoughts on that and in conjunction with that, the privacy concerns that it raises.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the first things I thought when I read this is it's kind of ironic that, here we are seeing a proposal for a consortium amongst telco providers in order to collect user data for the purposes of targeted advertising. But do we see the same efforts from those telcos to, for example, reduce and remove roaming charges across non-EU environments? I've never seen that level of collaboration between telco providers and network providers before. And I know the whole issue of roaming charges is a bit of a misnomer in Europe at the moment. There used to be, for non-EU listeners, there used to be an abolition of roaming charges across all European network providers. Then, of course, the UK left the European Union, and so it meant that British network providers and carriers could now implement roaming charges again. Some of them have, some of them haven't. But interestingly, Vodafone is one that has, and yep. Here they are sort of stepping up for the purposes of protecting consumers' data privacy. And so I just sort of found that an irony.
But it is. And I'm sorry, I don't want to really train a thought, but in a kind of simplistic way, you both talked about the consumer and what that means and the understanding. A practical example is I switch networks for going out to APAC, right? Because I used to be charged so much or not have data. So I left Telefonica and went to Vodafone. And that's a simple kind of user, what's going on with my data, but it was price driven. And I'm curious now, both of you are out on the other side of the world operating in different networks. And what does that mean? When you talk about privacy, you talk about different networks, what happens, my data, what goes on?
Well, this is the thing connected to what to the points that Addy raised. I actually think, you know, there's the question mark of why they're doing this in the first instance, and then there's how users are going to react to it and how customers are going to react to it. And I can't see any environment where the way that they're proposing that they would actually use customer data is through explicit opt-in. I can't see any way in which that's not going to be slightly annoying for users at the very least, and at the best, maybe really explicitly explained to them, but you're still perhaps going to be in the position as a customer of any of those providers thinking, well, hang on a minute, why am I agreeing to give you my data for the purposes of advertising when I already pay you anyway as a network provider? Yeah. Like what, who is making money off my data here and exactly who is looking after it? So, you know, I agree with Addy. I think the kind of customer and consumer angle is really strong here. And if you look at the story from that perspective, I'm not sure that it's a win for customers necessarily. And then that brings you right back to Addy's initial point, which is, why are they doing this again? I mean, yeah. I presumed that they were doing this because they were wanting to strengthen their own businesses in some way, shape or form. But it's pretty clear from reading the article that it's not like they'll be, this is not giving them any permission to share that data amongst one another. They can't use it for targeting purposes across their networks. So I mean, what will happen is they'll create a, you know, non-personally identifiable token, which then the advertiser can target advertising to, but I'm just not sure what the ultimate benefit to the telco will be. So it's kind of confusing.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anything you can add from a regional perspective from APAC, because I think this is it's quite European focused. We've got global listeners. And is there anything that you can kind of localize in terms of various networks or how, you know, operators behave?
From a global perspective, I did, again, looked at, I wondered if anything like this had ever been launched before, and invariably it probably has in the US. And indeed, but there are a couple of examples, you know, from within the last decade of Verizon and AT&T launching kind of similar initiatives, which didn't land well for various different reasons. I think the other point I was going to touch on actually, but that Rachel raised, was the user experience, which by the from what I'd read in the article and from my understanding would quite frankly be atrocious. It was talking about yet another consent pop-up appearing, which, you know, on a mobile device is probably arguably even more annoying than it would be on a desktop. The proposal, from what I'd read, would be that a consent pop-up would appear for every single brand and every single publisher. Each time, it would be only, even if you consented, which would be questionable, it would only be valid for 90 days, at which point another pop-up would appear to state, do you want to opt in or opt out again? And it just seems that it would, it would be, I can't really see why that would occur. And again, the last point I'll make on it was looking at, you know, the opt-in rates for these type of consent mechanisms, quite well documented, but you look at the Apple app tracking transparency, when that was introduced with, what was it, iOS 14, it's around 25% of active users opt in to tracking. And you just feel like, you know, if it's a telco user asking, the numbers would be even lower, you would imagine. So almost kind of begs the question, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that, because also if you dig into, as the article did, it was actually a really well-written article, but if you dig into the ways in which they have had to build the proposal in order to satisfy privacy regulators in Europe, it's really quite clear about all of the mechanisms that they have to do to ensure that this is absolutely consented first-party data. So as you mentioned, Addy, they've got to, you know, it's got to refresh every 90 days. It's got to be really explicit, the ask for permission. And not only that, it's got to be, you know, they've already proposed the way in which they would put the consent banner together. So it's got to have a very explicit upfront top of the most obvious choice to opt out. And I just think that's going to drive users to opt out without even thinking about it. And then if they do get opted in users, they've also agreed to undertake this really, what sounds to me like quite onerous auditing process of all of the advertisers that use that data. Yeah. And, you know, I guess if you're thinking about it as from a sort of, you know, pure play publisher publisher perspective. If it's about building their own good quality first-party data infrastructure, okay. But it just seems to have mixed, you know, it's trying to achieve quite a number of things, and I'm not sure it's going to achieve all of those things. And in fact, it might run the risk of achieving none of those things, because it also mightn't get past the privacy regulators, right?
Yeah, that's true. But if you strip it back down and you look at it from maybe just pure consumer person, what personally, I just kind of go, yeah, just I'll click anything right now to get on to what I want to do.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people will. But then I also think, as Addie raised, a lot of people won't if they are if they're very obviously given the option not to. And also because it's such a personalized environment on a mobile device. Yeah. Like you said, it's a bit of an extension of yourself. And I do think people, consumers, are becoming much more wary about consenting in a mobile environment than in other environments. There is just something innately kind of intrusive about messages being sent to you on a mobile. You know what we're all like as human beings. We always used to joke about how, you know, when we all got used to messaging each other on WhatsApp and maybe weren't so good at the privacy controls in the early days, we'd be like, oh, I miss, you know, text messaging when nobody knew whether you'd open the message or not. And so there wasn't this pressure to reply. So, you know, it's amazing.
On your preferred choice. It depends. I'm not going to mention anything. But it, that's a knowledge base. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I think sometimes we live and breathe this so much that we forget the day-to-day Joe blogs, for want of a better description. And you're right, Rachel, the information that they're provided with. And in Europe, it's rubbish. In the UK, it's crap. Most of my friends who don't work in our industry have no idea what information they're sharing. They're not dumb people. You know, they just generally, there's a lack of information. And that's, I think, where the problem really kind of sits inherently. And if you take that to the degree when you're talking about telcos, I think there's a natural trust. Like you said, there's an exchange of money. It's not an exchange of, I'll give you this for that data. You can know about where I went this morning or what I like for breakfast, or there's a different barter. Most people are paying money. And that's, I think, where it really kind of needs to kind of zone in and go, yes, I'm paying money. And now what are you doing with me on top of that? If you want to reduce my subscription or my, you know, monthly, whatever it is you pay, then yeah, mix it up.
Definitely. Agree.
Sorry. Okay. Look, I'm going to move on to the next story because I think it's kind of quite timely in a way, and it's about identity and cookie replacement, which kind of feeds in nicely. And this is a story from DigiDay where they talk about how marketers are finding it difficult to determine which solution will best support their post-cookie strategies. And this kind of ranges of targeting alternatives on offer, spanning across deterministic, probabilistic and contextual. And it says that it's leaving advertisers at a kind of loss over which tech providers to partner with, right? Now, I'm pretty sure that there'll be a lot of people leaning in this particular discussion. And Addie, you know, you've, over your experience, work with partners, you're a client, you're a provider. But in this particular article, it says the question is further complicated by the fact that different regions have different privacy rules that make some technologies incompatible in certain markets. Industry insiders suggest that consider three factors: privacy, intent, and scale. And that's when you're assessing whether a solution or a partner is the right fit for them. Under privacy, marketers should ensure they know where data is derived from, know what, that it has been handled in line with applicable regulations, and that they understand how the ID vendor authenticates users. And from an intent perspective, advertisers should seek to understand whether a solution complies with data laws to acquire user consent and how easy it makes it for a user to opt out. And for scale, marketers should ask for more detail about vendors' audiences, such as their match rate and how they separate different kinds of identifiers, such as maybe at a household level versus individual. And it goes on, right? So, Rachel, I'm going to give Addie a time to think because this, I mean, not you don't need it, Addie, but this is your day in, day out to a degree. But Rachel, in your perspective and, you know, the conversations that you have on a daily basis across brand marketers, agencies, publishers. Do you feel like the post-cookie kind of cookieless landscape has become too complicated?
So in short, and I'm glad, AMS, that you're coming to me for the non-expert view before we go to Addy for the expert view. Yes, I do think it's if I'm thinking about the conversations that I have with people, as you've just mentioned there, yes, I think it is too complicated, in that there still is a real mismatch in terms of knowledge and understanding of what tools and solutions are available out there in the market from the buy side, so from brands and marketers, less so agencies. I'm quite sure a lot of agency execs and specialists are really quite up to speed with what's available and have plenty of sort of avenues to go to get that information. But I think brands and marketers still feel a little bit uninformed, and you know, no one's to blame for that. I think they would openly admit that this is for a variety of reasons. I then think that every single brand and marketer is at a different stage in their journey in terms of how their marketing strategy is unfolding, what their tech stack looks like, what their approach in general to, you know, marketing and advertising technology is, you know, whether they are, you know, what solutions they've procured, what stuff they might already have in-house, what specialists they've got to work on things, and what agency partners and other partners they might be using to get to the bottom of all of that. And so everyone's at a different point in the journey. And then I also think there's enormous regional differences, right? And I'm sure Addy can speak to this, you know, in APAC, which is very fragmented anyway, you know, you've got all sorts of variety of markets across APAC, everything from Japan and China to Australia and New Zealand and all of Southeast Asia in between. You know, there's so many different stories to tell there when it comes to preparation for advertising and marketing beyond third-party cookies, you know, and how each of those regions and their commensurate governments are approaching consumer privacy. It's just all so different, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, yes, I think it is too complex because of all of those reasons I've just mentioned, but also because I don't think of any of the solutions that we're aware of, I don't think that there is any silver bullet in any of them. And I also don't think that any of them offer real scale for brands and marketers. So it's not as though we're going to come to a position where
we have... You know, Addy works for Oracle, right? I'm pretty sure they've got scale there. This isn't teeing you up because I will quickly take you down as well.
Yeah, well, there we go. So let's see what Addy's got to say. But my point being, I don't think that what we're going to find is a like-for-like replacement, because I think the whole world of marketing and advertising will change from here onwards. We've been talking about it for years at ATS events and at various, you know, bits and pieces of content on the site. This world of moving away from the kind of one or two quite dominant, or maybe three dominant walled garden environments, to a plethora of mini walled gardens, where actually brands and marketers and buyers are going to be in a position where they're going to need different solutions in each of those environments. And there won't be one identity that will necessarily be usable across them all. But listen, I'll stop now because I think the expert needs to say something.
I'm going to jump over to you, but I think you raised a lot of really interesting points there, right? So, you know, it's also at the end of the day, the marketers are just human beings as well. And they don't know what the right answer is, and they're looking for solutions. They may not know the right questions to ask, which is scary if you've got this huge responsibility and there's a certain onus on, oh yeah, you go and sort this out. And you sort this out in this market, in this market, in this market. And it's, I would imagine it's horrifying trying to get your head around
an impossible job.
And your peers and your, you know, I'm fortunate that I work in an organization where it's, you can ask whatever you want, right? And no one makes you feel like an idiot. And it's absolutely, that's how we live and breathe. And we question each other all the time. And what does this mean? And how does it work? And I think that kind of hopefully is why people listen to podcasts like this. Addy, this is where I'm going to come to you. Kind of, there must be huge pros and cons in terms of the options that are out there and what's available and how you articulate your proposition without going into a pitch. For your client, you've got various clients at different levels, at different sizes, regardless of budgets. It must be so complex. What can you share that our listeners can kind of take away and kind of go, shit, it's not just me. I'm not the only one that is kind of waking up in the middle of the night. And Sorry, big question. Off you go.
Well, yeah, you're not going to like this because you probably want me to disagree with what you said, but I can't not agree with your points. It is incredibly complicated. I think that's what we do really well in this industry. We overcomplicate things, sometimes for good reason, sometimes not for good reason. But yeah, absolutely, yes, at the moment, based on my personal experience speaking with clients over recent months, it's way too complicated. And as you kind of mentioned, AMS, in full disclosure, I'm probably a little bit biased because we already offer a pretty straightforward solution to cookieless targeting called Context. But we also partner with a lot of ID consortiums. And I think you kind of nailed it, Rachel. There's no silver bullet. I think everybody is going to have to work with multiple vendors to provide the necessary scale to make this an actionable, to provide an optimum solution for whatever business you work in. But for marketers, it's just it's a bit of a nightmare right now, to be honest. I loved in this article, by the way, there was it was really eloquently put together. I think the quote described it as a tsunami of sales pitches. So you can imagine from every single vendor, and I've worked for a vendor now, but I used to work for publishers before and had been pitched to many times. It's really hard to sort fact from fiction, and to be able to ask the right questions, to be able to delve to see behind the emperor's clothes and see past the emperor's clothes and find out, well, is there meaningful scale? How have you collected this data? Is it absolutely consent driven? And if it's not, who's liable for that? Because I think it's the jury's out on kind of where the buck stops for marketers who want to who clearly want future-proof targeting solutions, but don't quite know where to turn. So in the article as well, I delved a little bit deeper, and I downloaded a copy of the Identity Partners List 5.0, I think it was, from Prohaska Consulting. There were over 100 different partners.
Hi, Matt.
Who I've never met before, but the moment I downloaded that article, he's connected.
Lovely guy.
So it's, well,
yes, no, and he's a lovely guy. You'll meet him somewhere soon, I'm sure.
Awesome. And we're in the mix, great, as I would have expected. And there's a load of, the other usual suspects, but there were quite a number of players that I'd never heard of before. Maybe that's just me. From putting my old hat on, if I'd not met a vendor before, I'd probably undertake a little bit more due diligence than I would otherwise. But again, that was really concerning for me. Looking at the state of the current landscape, the apparent onus is on clients to navigate that level of complexity. And when you, as you mentioned, AMS, there's different regulations in different markets. Yeah. It's just a minefield.
It must be. I mean, how do you manage it? There's these old prevention's better than cure, and knowledge is power. And what's really interesting, Rachel's been in the weeds in APAC for the past couple of weeks, just chatting to people about what's going on. We've been doing the same thing out in Europe for building, kind of trying to get a sense of what people want to hear about in the next ATS. But one of the things is that the thirst for knowledge and the thirst for new tech and the thirst for information from client side is just phenomenal. Would you agree, Rachel? It's like, show me, we want to learn, we want to see, we want to come to these events, we want to, show me what you do. We don't want any of these nice, flashy presentations. Show me what your tech does. Help me understand how you can solve my problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'd totally agree with that. And I think it connects to what Addy just said, which is that, if you are on the receiving end of a tsunami of pitches, like you said, it becomes really difficult to differentiate them, right? Because there is a patter to a lot of these propositions. People are all using the same buzzwords and the same language, and everyone's saying that they can do exactly what you need them to do. But I think there is definitely a thirst for actionable knowledge. So, people saying, well, look, we've used, you know, and it's going to be colleagues and peers, right? It's going to be other brands, other advertisers or other agency folks able to say, look, we've used this particular tool in this, you know, sort of environment, and it worked really well to get us this particular result. And I think the other thing, you know, about the article is that it also really highlighted the degree to which brands and marketers have got to put themselves in the position of test and learn. You know, that's often put forward as a really good way to deal with a lot of, complexity and tech challenge. And so that's a great idea. You know, get yourself in the mindset of let's test and learn and see what works, see what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And let's also have ourselves in the mindset that we're probably going to have to change things every, I don't know how often, but, you know, we're not going to find one solution that's going to work forevermore. We're going to be doing this for a bit. Then we're going to have to do some more testing and learning and see what happens next. And I think I think all of that's great and all, but like, what if you're a small brand that doesn't have that kind of time,
that budget, that test budget, those teams kind of go, oh yeah, go out and have a chat and listen to X, Y, and Z and see what they've got to say and come back and tell me what you think. And it's hard from both sides, I think, and especially, you know, there's no denying we're 2023, no matter what region you're in, it's going to be another tough year. I mean, it's not like we haven't had enough tough years. And everyone's just going to be more and more cautious, and it's going to be harder. You're going to have to kind of get that cut through and going to go, this is going to save you money or make you money. But that's very kind of short term thinking. And with the tech that's involved here, I think, how do we kind of create an environment where people can be educated and learn and kind of go, look, I'm not asking you to kind of integrate this massive, extensively over, you know, complicated, pricey solution. There's a way that you can kind of integrate whatever you're doing. There's a way that we can look at what tech stack you're using already, and let's be smarter about what you're doing, and let's open up some of the data and the information that you've already got there that perhaps you're not already optimizing, that you can be a little bit more efficient about. But opening up those conversations when people, if you look at it at a personal level, if you are just kind of going through whatever shitstorm in life, you're not necessarily open to kind of go, oh yeah, I'm going to take on this new idea. Emotionally, you're in a very different place. And I think sometimes in our world, we're so kind of data-driven in tech and stats, and we're all just people and buying solutions to make our lives a bit easier and keep ourselves in a job, or it depends on who you are, make yourself look like a hero, or I don't know. But there's an element of realism that goes on, and it's not getting any easier. And whatever we can do to break that down, and I know I need to move on to the next story, but hopefully we can pick this up. Addie, you've probably got loads of things that you can add to that, because day in, day out, you're faced with huge organisations, small organisations, different needs, and opening them up and kind of from a place of, you know, genuine, if we understand where you're at, then we can try and help you. But finding that where they're at,
I think broadly speaking, you can put the range of solutions into three different buckets, whether it's deterministic, probabilistic, or contextual. I don't think anyone would disagree that deterministic probably offers the optimum solution, but not everybody has the luxury of having, you know, swathes of first party consented data. It also carries the greatest risk in terms of, you know, have you obtained the necessary consent? We've seen with, you know, the likes of Meta in recent weeks, even though they believe, you know, they believe that they've obtained explicit consent, maybe the powers that be decide, you know, determine that that's not quite the case. It also poses, you know, the biggest challenge in terms of scale as well, because as we just covered, there's not everybody has the luxury of, particularly outside of North America, you don't necessarily have, you know, as much scale to play with. So you need a combination of the two. And I think from a simplistic perspective, you can probably put them all on a spectrum. So you've got compliance, in terms of compliance and scale, as you move across from deterministic, probabilistic, and contextual. And I think that most, to your point again, AMS, I think if most marketers are looking to test and learn, you'd probably want to test the first, you know, deterministic and maybe a bit of probabilistic if you can, but inevitably you're going to have to supplement that with some contextual targeting as well, just to, you know,
you're putting your neck on the line to a degree, and you're drawing in different partners and different units within your own business. You know, it's quite complex, and I look, we desperately need to move on, but I think the message, I don't know if you agree, information is out there. Don't be afraid to ask the questions or find out. I think that is how can we break down those barriers. I'm going to go, don't be scared.
Yeah, I think we need to just keep encouraging conversation, right? And keep encouraging question asking and debating and so forth. Yeah. Because, you know, you're right, marketers will feel to an extent like they're putting their neck on the line here. And it doesn't help that, you know, Addy, as you just mentioned, we've seen examples of huge companies being hauled up in front of regulators for misinterpreting the rules. So it's very much still a sort of a changing landscape as well. I don't even think the regulators have decided exactly which side of the fence various activities fall. Either. And I'm not saying, you know, that they literally sit around going, let's decide whether this is against the law or within the law. I'm not saying it's that
if
contrary.
If they do, I'd like a job there.
It'd be quite fun, wouldn't it?
I reckon they'd be quite fun. A fairly decent wage, but yeah.
But I think it's a really complex area of law.
Yeah, and an interesting fact as well. I mean, you asked about regional variances, and there's a significant fine that you just talked about, which just kind of highlighted, and the GDPR enforces, I think it's either a fine of 20 million euros or 4% of gross annual turnover. In Thailand, for example, in Southeast Asia, they introduced the PDPA mid last year, and individuals can be sent to jail for a breach of those regulations. And so as a marketer, do you want to take the risk that, you know, is he either A, going to cost you a job, isn't it?
I mean, I'm a fan of go hard or go home, but that this is literally taking it to another level.
I mean, there are many reasons you don't want to be in a Thai jail. You especially don't want to be in one for having sort of disobeyed some data privacy law. That would be bad times.
I was just trying to provide targeted advertising. I just wanted the users to have a better experience. Come on.
No way, man.
It was a great offer.
Yeah. It's been a long time since I've been in Thailand, but the imagery is still there. We simply move on to the next story, which is about Truva, right? It's the live stream video platform owned by Tencent. So, regionally specific, but probably a lot of lessons that we can learn internationally. So this is a deal with the new live streaming tool that reportedly enables brands and content creators to use interactive ads to bolster their earnings. So they use sponsorship automation technology to provide ads that can avoid being blocked. According to this article by MediaPost, the move marks a shift by the Twitch competitor, who previously placed audience contributions as essential to kind of influencers' monetization efforts. Truvo's 600,000 influencers would traditionally accrue revenue by streaming via the platform's PK Arena. Now, this platform hosted rewarded challenges and enabled viewers to make donations to their favorite content creators. But in this article, according to partnership deals between Truvo and Uplify, the live streaming technology provider will work to secure sponsorship deals for influencers and insert engaging interactive ads into live stream on the platform. I mean, we've really jumped from the fire into the fire here, I think, in terms of decision making and where you put your budget. But Addy, I'm going to come to you because regionally it's a minefield, as you've just kind of outlined, but in your opinion, what do you think does this means in terms of what does the move tell us about the kind of value of the creator/influencer economy?
So this, I love this article. Because in all honesty, I don't know an awful lot about Trovo. I know that they're owned by Tencent. And yeah. I don't know an awful lot about live stream video platforms in general, to be perfectly honest. But it was, when I read the details, my first impression was, they seem tiny in comparison with Twitch. I mean, what did it say? They've got 5 million active users versus 140 million monthly active users on Twitch. Yeah. But if we've learned anything from, the likes of TikTok, for example, we know that Chinese companies are willing to provide whatever resources they need to innovate and scale their business. And they're pretty decent, pretty good at it as well. Mm-hmm. When I looked at the number of influencers as well, I mean, they claim to have 600,000 influencers active on the platform, which is nearly 10% of their overall user base. So there's a lot of influencers who were apparently previously incentivized by receiving rewards from the users. So I'd love to see what type of content it was. Initially, I thought it was a gaming, you know, live streaming of gaming. So I guess, you know, people are achieving certain, you know, doing particularly well on certain popular games, and people would report them for, or whatever the case might be. But it turns out they're not gaming specific. So it's worth calling out that arguably they've got greater potential for growth, given that they're attracting a broader audience than Twitch. Having said that, knowing some people that, you know, who work at Twitch, of course, they've been diversifying their content beyond gaming for quite a while now, and they've got the, like, you know, they've got Amazon to lean on for things like sports content. So I think they've already got NFL and NBA rights in the US, for example. So that, you know, that's an interesting angle for them to approach. So I feel like this new technology is a company called Uplify. It says that they're providing block-resistant ads with up to a 78% recall rate. Now, I don't know about you guys. I think block. There's a clue in the name, block-resistant. So I'm imagining like this pop-up that takes over the screen. We've probably talked about this in the past. It is sports content. I think users are kind of used to seeing. Advertising, it's kind of goes part and parcel with that event. But I don't know if it's gaming, or if there's these influencers are engaging, whatever activities the people are interested in. And I don't know how receptive users would be to block resistant advertising that they can't escape. And in this example, I'm not even convinced that a really high recall rate is fantastic, because that's not necessarily measuring. Was the recall positive or negative? And if it's negative, I'd argue, is that a good thing for the brand? That would be my initial kind of 50 cents on it.
That's a really good point, actually. And, you know, what you could kind of go, what is an influencer in this environment? And Rachel, I'm sure you've got some thoughts around this.
I just I have to agree with Addy that, you know, that the thing that really stood out for me was this you know, fantastic solution that provides these you know, sort of interactive live stream ads that are block resistant. That just to me speaks kind of low value hyper casual gaming, actually. And even those ads, well, they're not block resistant either, but you've sort of just got to, you know, you can eventually skip over them. But I just don't know what that actually does for the user experience. And so I thought, listening to you just talk there, Addy, it's made me feel even more like this, that this feels like a sort of a journey perhaps that Trovo are on, from live streaming company to, gaming, live streaming gaming platform to begin with, to live streaming more broad, regular content. So sort of starting to move back into a more of a video world, and you sort of a YouTube-y type audience, broad audience and beyond. And then with the sort of ads attached to live stream activity that's being produced by, you know, content creators that are influencers, it's almost a bit TikTok-y and Instagram-y a little bit. So it feels like a mishmash of a number of different potential offerings, and they're just trying to build and grow it, you know, as quickly as possible with quite frankly, what will be no doubt a very compelling monetization tool, right? So you're right, they're significantly smaller in comparison to Twitch. But if they implement, a tool like this to a really highly active and engaged influencer audience, I'm sure those influencers will try it out as soon as possible. And if it works and it's making them money, then that could really explode, right?
But there you go.
But I guess it begs the question, what type of users will they be attracted to the platform? And quite frankly, I feel like we need to ask a teenager about this, because right, I don't feel just, like I'm you, the right demographic.
You completely just stole my lack of thunder.
Sorry.
I was sitting here listening to you going, yeah, valid point. But how do I position this, kind of going, we're too old for this shit. But it's challenging, because I've got a friend that works, she does many things, but works with influencers and is championing trying to get them paid the right money for what they do. And it's diversity driven. And there's so many complications around what you do. And the only kind of, not the only thing, one of the things that I kind of took from this, they don't need to have massive money, massive influences, massive numbers. For me, if they're doing something well and they're doing it right and there's good value exchange and their influencers are paying being paid proportionately well and they're happy and it's all kind of transparent, then who cares if there's 60,000, 600,000, if they're providing information and there's an exchange and there's just that barter, great. And they're being remunerated accordingly and it's all above board. I would go there 100 times more than 6 billion with other providers. You know what I mean? But that's just that's a personal choice. And I say that and not having a clue because I don't engage in these worlds.
Do you have a Twitch account? Do you have a Trovo account, AMS? I mean, personally, I don't.
I Twitch on a regular basis. That's just uncomfortableness.
But I don't, I mean, you know, in answer to the question, what does it tell you about the value of the creator or influencer economy? I think it tells us that, you know, this is a growing economy and it's not really slowing down, but I think it's yet another area of sort of digital media that's going to change dramatically over the coming sort of 12 to 24 months. And I think that will be driven by engagement and, you know, what demographic and how many of that demographic are using these platforms and what they're using them for. Sorry, Adi, I didn't mean to talk over you there.
No, not at all. I think it'll be it's clearly going to be a really interesting space to watch, to keep an eye on. I'm sure that Twitch will be keeping an eye on what's happening. I guess the end goal is for Trovo and other kind of challenger live stream platforms is to attract more influencers who are going to in turn will generate more content and attract more users. So it sounds like a very sensible growth strategy. They arguably or undoubtedly got the opportunity to test and learn more easily and act more nimbly than an incumbent market leader like Twitch, where I'm sure they'd face a lot more resistance to something like block resistant ads negatively or inversely impact the user experience. So I wouldn't be massively surprised if this is a good move, although clearly only time will tell.
It's going to be behavior driven, right? It's going to be market driven, you know, age. I don't know, I'm afraid to say anything in case I get into trouble for how I define people or places or doing, you know, whatever. But ultimately, it's where you are, what you're doing in the right place. If you go back to the basics of when we started in this world, crazy world of, you know, you want to talk to someone in the right place at the right time with the right message. Now you choose the platform, you use the right person, or you use the right channel. And these are influencers. This is where you just engage people. And this is what I find particularly interesting, Adi, where, you know, the transition that you've made in terms of from a personal and a kind of professional way, right? If we look at, you worked in Europe for a number of years. Earlier on, you talked about various experiences. Now you work in Asia, right? So do you mind if we kind of just take some time just to dig into this a little bit more, you know, looking at it from a kind of a professional and an operational perspective, the lessons that you've learned from in Europe out to Asia in, what is it, 3-4 years? And even in that time through a pandemic, it must be mind blowing in a way, in kind of the cultural differences, the operational differences. I know it might seem like I'm jumping, but I think it's quite relevant to kind of put into perspective your experiences in answering these questions and looking at different providers and solutions and stuff. I feel like I've done a great compound question there. Loads of, sorry, that's no disrespect to you, Rachel. Mine was just like blah, 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 blah. Adi, how's life in Singapore? Even though you're in Australia at the moment.
Singapore, Australia. You're right. I'm still relatively new. Only 3 years since I, just over 3 years since I left the UK. And punctured, of course, by a global pandemic. So I think everybody's kind of normal methods of working have massively, massively shifted. I think when I moved out here, it was, you know, were there operational differences? Probably the biggest one, the most obvious one, would be the time difference, which I think everybody would be aware of. And, you know, maybe I hadn't realized just how taxing it would be in terms of being available for calls with the US and being available for calls with the UK and combating all of these different time zones. And when I first moved out here, I met a very kind of extensive expat community who were who kind of pre-pandemic had already adjusted to a more flexible way of working. So, they seemed to be available at various different times of the day, and they found a way of making it work so that they could take those really early calls and the late calls, and they'd find some time for themselves and their families in between. And I think that was, that was one area that was perhaps we've all found, everybody's found a better balance and a better way of coping throughout the pandemic, because we've all had to, we've all been remote working. From an internal perspective, there are various ways that we needed to be able to kind of make sure that the team here didn't feel too ostracized from our HQ, which for my company happens to be in the US, but albeit we report into an international team that's based in London. So, we found various ways that we can, if there's a town hall or if there's a session with the product team, we'll all meet in the office and we'll sit down and we'll watch a recording together, so at least people aren't, sitting there and kind of skipping stuff or, not being able to have the same level of interaction that you might do with a live recording. The other kind of challenges, I guess, or differences between Europe and working in Asia, I'd say I was probably quite surprised at it in our business that third party audiences were so prevalent, as opposed to in Europe, of course, where the GDPR had come into force a number of years back, and people had already shifted to cookie-less privacy compliance solutions. And then I guess comparing Europe, because, and then Asia and the US, where we do have audiences, the scale isn't quite the same as it is in the US, for example. So we've had to, we've built country-specific taxonomies for a lot of our clients to help them avoid the pitfall of seeing this enormous scale, but then when they come to deliver campaigns, it's not really there. There's language variation, of course, so we have to make sure that, a lot of our solutions are available in different markets. In the US, you've just got one language, of course, generally
speaking.
Oh,
really? I don't know. That's debatable. Yeah. But anyway, that's a different podcast.
Very debatable. Well, and in Southeast Asia alone, you've got to cater for Mandarin, Malay, Bahasa, Tagalog, Vietnamese, Thai.
But you wouldn't even be able to roll those off 3 years ago, would you?
I don't think so.
But that's the beauty, I think, about the knowledge that you've had. Even if you, this is no disrespect to the 3% of us, US people that have a passport. Those that look at Europe as an example and kind of think it's one country, and they try and come over and go, yeah, we'll come over, we'll just take it, we'll do it. It's quite complex. And we see that on a daily basis, and we're, close, regardless of the language barriers. I feel a disconnect, and what I've learned in the 5-6 years that I've worked with Exchange were the knowledge of APAC, for example, or SEA or JPAC, or it depends. It's fragmented in a different way. And I think you're doing yourself a disservice in terms of what you have learned and the local knowledge that you've got in the time that you've been here. Yes, you're fortunate enough to work for a huge multinational company, but I think it comes down to the individual and the fact that you took that choice to be out there and understand what's going on at a local level.
And also maybe just as well, kind of, I found it really interesting, Addy, you talking about, you immersed yourself in this expat community where people were already kind of quite used to the transitions they'd had to make in their life to accommodate colleagues in the US, to accommodate colleagues in Europe, to sort of, I find sometimes with a lot of the APAC clients that we work with, they've got a certain way of describing things that is just a really polite way of constantly repeating that really important message. It's a really fragmented market here. Yeah. You can't do the same things here that you can do in the US, and so you stepped into a community that was already kind of quite up to speed on that. But you've had to do that yourself, and maybe part of what AMS is saying there as well is a testament to you that you've stuck it out, because it can't be easy. Mm. And you've got a family, you've got little kids. So how have you sort of juggled all of that? The late night calls, the early morning calls, if you've needed to do those?
A lot of it is having really supportive managers. So you make reference to the fact that I work for a large multinational company, and fortunately, a lot of the managers that I've had in the time that I've been here, and it's been a few, have similar experience. So they completely get it. They completely understand it. The community, I mean, I think the advertising technology community in general is just really supportive. So I think I'm very fortunate to count a lot of my peers as genuinely close friends. And so, and moving to a different continent, I've made some amazing lifelong friends who have been unbelievably willing to, you know, to provide guidance, even, you know, from what you might loosely term competitors. Frenemies is perfect. So super, super fortunate in that respect. I've probably learned the hard way as well, because you guys are being overly generous. I've made significant mistakes since I moved over here, probably from a cultural perspective as much as anything else.
I sneezed on a call with the Japanese team, if that makes you feel any better. It's basically like shitting on them. I couldn't help it. It was a video call, but, you know, shit happens, Eddie. Don't give yourself a hard time. So, you know, you've built a business over there and through a really tough time. So give yourself a break.
The pandemic wasn't helpful, because it meant there were months when you couldn't meet in groups of more than two, so it's pretty difficult. But especially the local team as well, the Singaporeans that I've met there, they've kind of encouraged me to not sit at my desk at lunchtime and eat on my own, which was kind of the way that everybody I used to operate in London.
London,
it's just ridiculous.
But weirdly, who knew? It's actually important and quite fun to sit down and have lunch together. Just kind of, you know, catch up on what's going on in people's lives. There were times, probably, you know, when I first moved out here, I couldn't understand why people didn't put their video cameras on, why they weren't asking me those questions, maybe, you know, what was going on. And it was, you know, it wasn't because people weren't interested, again, naively coming from, you know, having moved from London. And there was a kind of, yeah, maybe people aren't engaged in that, or they're not interested, or something's not going on. It's not the case at all. People are engaged, they're watching, they're listening, learning, and they don't want to cause offence sometimes by asking too many questions. So engaging in a slightly different manner on a one-to-one basis, you can get some feedback on whatever it is that you're presenting, etc. And then probably from a leadership perspective, sometimes this challenge is probably exacerbated through the remote working, but people don't necessarily want to put themselves forward and promote themselves in the same way that we would expect them to from the UK, where we're all pretty good at saying how great we are, what a great job we did, and how we delivered X, Y, and Z results. And certainly with my team, they're just a lot more humble.
There's a Travis Teo, you get a little shout out. He's a small but growing business that's absolutely phenomenal and has been winning awards. But he is a great advocate for recognizing his team and his partners.
And maybe that's something that we can learn from the APAC region as well, Adi. I like the way you put it, a bit of humbleness, in this sort of global rankings of self-promotion. I would say the Brits are not at the top of the scale by any stretch of imagination.
The global, was that a W or an A?
they're not self-promotion takes on very lots of different guises, I suppose. Yeah. But maybe we can learn something from our Asian colleagues about different ways to do business. And I also find it's a very relationship driven, I know the industry is very relationship driven. It's what gives it that fantastic edge that you mentioned, Adi, which is that it's oftentimes a lovely sort of mixture of frenemies rather than out competitors. There's lots of support amongst colleagues within the industry in a global context, which is great. But I also think that maybe there is just something about encouraging one another rather than being adversaries. And I think that's a positive thing. And I find that APAC's relationship driven in that sense. People do want to get to know one another, and they want to get to know a little bit about their colleagues and their co-workers' lives. And so that the lunch example you gave is a really strikes a really good image in my mind. And I have to say, whenever I'm in Singapore, it explains why, if I'm going for a meeting at lunchtime, everywhere's packed and there's literally teams of people going out for lunch. It's a daily thing, and I think that's great.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah. And the collaboration you talked about as well, just lastly to touch upon, and I think in one of the topics that we discussed, it was how do we best prepare, how do marketers best prepare themselves for cookie deprecation and post cookie targeting solutions. They need to talk with one another, and certainly that happens in all, like, it seems to be a lot more prevalent in the Asia Pacific region than I had witnessed in London, where perhaps people were slightly more competitive and wouldn't always talk as much as they should do in that kind of open environment. But as marketers in this region, I've definitely seen a willingness to share, collaborate, and ultimately move forwards towards finding an optimum solution, learning from each other, and it's good to see.
Yeah, it's good. We need more of it this side of the world, I think. I think it's improved a little bit, but I think definitely we can take some huge learnings from the APAC region. And on that note, unfortunately, we've run out of time. We've gone over time, but I think it was a fascinating conversation. So thank you very much, Addy, and thank you, Rachel. But this is it. This is the end of the MadTech podcast from Exchanger this week. So thank you, Addy. Thank you, Rachel.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks, AMS.
Thank you, listeners. And hopefully we'll have you back next week.